Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
South Africa banned travel from three Ebola-affected nations, and troops are pledged for an East African standby force. I'm Frances Alonso reporting from Washington. South Africa has banned travel to and from the Ebola-stricken nations of Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone, echoing a move by Kenya last week. South African health officials say they've also implemented screening and treatment measures for visitors. From Johannesburg, VOA's Anita Powell reports.
South Africa is closing its ports of entry to travelers from three nations hit hardest by the deadly Ebola virus: Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. Of the three, Liberia has been hardest hit, with the World Health Organization estimating that 90% of Ebola deaths have happened there. Nigeria, which has also seen more than a dozen Ebola cases, is not at this time on the banned list. South Africa's health minister announced the move this week. South African Health Department spokesman Joe Mela says South African citizens will be allowed to return home from those countries, but only after they are carefully screened for signs of the deadly virus. He says South Africans wishing to go to any of those countries will be quizzed by immigration officials at the airport and asked to postpone the trip unless it is truly urgent. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Defense chiefs from 10 East African countries have pledged a total of 5,000 troops to a new regional standby force for deployment by December. Rwanda's army spokesman says the officials made the pledges at a meeting in Kigali. Malaysia is observing a day of national mourning as the first remains of 43 of its citizens killed aboard the Malaysian Airlines flight MH17 were returned to Kuala Lumpur. A chartered flight carrying the bodies and ashes of 20 Malaysians arrived early today at the Kuala Lumpur International Airport, where a somber ceremony was held. This is VOA News. Hamas has claimed responsibility for kidnapping and killing three Israeli teenagers in June. It's the incident that led to the current war in Gaza. Hamas leader Saleh Arouri told a conference in Turkey today that Hamas's military wing carried out the operation with the goal of starting an uprising. He was speaking at the International Union for Muslim Scholars in Istanbul. The United Nations says the death toll from Syria's three-year-long civil war has surpassed 191,000. The figure was released today by the UN Human Rights Office and is more than double the last estimate provided by the UN a year ago. UN Rights Chief Navi Pillay acknowledged that even the latest figure, that covers a period between March 2011 and April this year, likely underestimates those killed. Pillay slammed international paralysis on the conflict, which she has said has helped embolden the killers, destroyers, and torturers in Syria. The UN Refugee Agency reports its largest aid operation in a decade to bring emergency supplies into northern Iraq's Kurdistan region is in full spring. The operation aims to improve conditions for close to 500,000 people. Lisa Schlein reports.
The operation is set to last 10 days. The UN Refugee Agency plans to ship 2,410 tons of non-food aid into Erbil, Kurdistan by air, land, and sea. Three airlifts of thousands of items such as tents, plastic sheeting, and kitchen sets have taken place. The UNHCR says it plans a fourth and final flight on Saturday. On the same day, a first ship is due to sail to Bandar Abbas in Iran. From there, the agency says the ship's relief cargo will be trucked into Erbil. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The first trucks in a Russian aid convoy sent to Ukraine have arrived in the war-ravaged eastern city of Luhansk. Reports say the trucks arrived today after beginning to move across the border without clearance from Ukraine. Ukraine's president is accusing Russia of violating international law, and the country's foreign minister says Russia's moves amount to a direct invasion, but that Ukraine would not use airstrikes against the convoy. The European Union said Russia has a clear violation of the Ukrainian border and urged Moscow to reverse its decision. Japan says the death toll could double to over 80 from landslides that buried dozens of homes on the outskirts of Hiroshima earlier this week. Officials said today the number of missing people rose to 52. That is in addition to 39 people already confirmed dead in the Wednesday landslides. The search has been temporarily called off because of heavy rains. I'm Frances Alonso.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Suhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Outgoing UN Human Rights Commissioner Navi Pillay has scolded the UN Security Council for its lack of action on some of the world's most serious crises, saying hundreds of thousands of lives could have been saved through greater council.
From the United Nations, that's VOA's Margaret Bashir reporting. Details coming up.
Also in the news, the militant group Boko Haram has seized another town in northeastern Nigeria, and the total number of confirmed Ebola infections in Nigeria has risen to 14.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Ivory Coast, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, outgoing UN Human Rights Commissioner Navi Pillay has scolded the UN Security Council for its lack of action on some of the world's most serious crises. She says hundreds of thousands of lives could have been saved through greater council responsiveness. From the UN, VOA's Margaret Bashir has more.
Former South African jurist Navi Pillay will wrap up a six-year tenure as the top UN human rights official at the end of this month. Known for her outspokenness on topics ranging from the conflict in Syria to gay rights, in her final briefing, Pillay spoke of crises around the world, from the Middle East to Africa to the Ukraine.
None of these crises erupted without warning. They built up over years and sometimes decades of human rights grievances, deficient or corrupt governance and judicial institutions, discrimination and exclusion, inequities in development, exploitation and denial of economic and social rights, and repression of civil society and public freedoms.
She said early detection mechanisms repeatedly warned of these potential crises.
So, although the specifics of each crisis could not necessarily be predicted, many of the human rights violations that were at their core were known. They could have been addressed.
On the more than three-year war in Syria, she warned the conflict is spreading outward and its eventual limits cannot be predicted. Pillay said such crises highlight the full cost of the international community's failure to prevent conflict. She said it is first the state's duty to protect its citizens, but when it fails, the UN Security Council must act.
But when governments are unwilling or unable to protect their people, it is the responsibility of the international community and singularly this council to intervene and to deploy the range of good offices, support, inducements, and coercion at its disposal to diffuse the triggers of conflict.
In an apparent reference to the lack of consensus among council members on issues such as Syria, she said short-term geopolitical concerns and narrowly defined national interests have repeatedly taken priority over ending human suffering.
I firmly believe that greater responsiveness by this council would have saved hundreds of thousands of lives.
During Thursday's meeting, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon paid tribute to Commissioner Pillay, saying she has been an outstanding United Nations leader who tells it like she sees it. He said people who face discrimination and rights abuses know she is their advocate and she will continue to be a key voice for human rights. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
The militant group Boko Haram has seized another town in northeastern Nigeria. The insurgents now occupy government buildings in Bunyadi, a regional administrative center in Yobe State. It's one of three states in which the federal government has declared a state of emergency. Boko Haram recently began occupying towns instead of employing hit-and-run tactics. Jacob Zena, Jamestown Foundation authority on Boko Haram, says the rebels are in effective control in Bunyadi and possibly several other towns. The Nigerian military has no presence in the town. Zen says Boko Haram recently gave up control of Damboa in Borno State. However, he adds, they destroyed the town before leaving. Zen says Boko Haram's probable destination is Maiduguri, the capital and largest city in Borno State. He says they may slowly encircle the city of more than 600,000 and attack in the same way radical Islamic State forces have approached Mosul in northern Iraq.
Ten minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Well, Senegal has closed its land borders with Guinea. It's also joined South Africa in shutting down all airline connections with the three West African countries hit hardest by the Ebola outbreak. Dakar is a regional air hub used by health workers who travel to West Africa. The World Health Organization argues that travel bans are counterproductive to containing the outbreaks and to preventing further deaths. UN officials are meeting today in Monrovia on the Ebola crisis with local officials. Also, Nigeria's health minister has confirmed the country's first cases of Ebola in people who did not have direct contact with Patrick Sawyer, an infected Liberian-American who traveled to Lagos from Liberia. Onabuchi Chukwu says the spouses of two Ebola patients who had contact with Sawyer have also become infected. Chukwu said today that the total number of confirmed infections in Nigeria had risen to 14. He said five people have died from the virus. New figures released today by the WHO show 2,615 confirmed cases of Ebola and 1,427 deaths. WHO officials also say that the actual number of Ebola victims is probably much higher. They cite several causes, including fear and stigma. They say many Ebola cases are in hard-to-reach remote areas, and some deny the existence of the disease or rely on traditional medicines. WHO says surveillance systems have proven inadequate to track the disease. When new isolation centers are created, they immediately receive two or three times the numbers they expected.
Health experts believe the epidemic will continue for many more weeks, possibly months, as officials try to contain current outbreaks with quarantines. The Ebola virus is not an airborne disease. It is transmitted from human to human through bodily fluids, blood, urine, feces, vomit, sweat, tears, saliva, mucus, and the genital secretions of those who have contracted the Ebola virus. Health officials strongly advise people to avoid touching bushmeat, which may be the original source of the virus. They warn people not to handle the bodies of the patients who have had died of Ebola. Instead, they should notify the nearest health center of any suspected Ebola cases and to immediately report to a health center if they experience symptoms of the virus, because early treatment may improve survival rates from 40% to as high as 70%. Symptoms of the Ebola virus include high fever, headache, joint or muscle aches, sore throat, weakness, stomach ache, and lack of appetite. These symptoms may occur 2 to 21 days after infection.
A Cornell University professor says when responding to the West Africa Ebola epidemic, officials must consider both the physical and social dimensions of healing. Stacy Landwick says the outbreak has dramatically changed the way people care for the sick. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
Langwick is studying the Ebola crisis through the eyes of a medical anthropologist, someone she says is most interested in behavior at the intersection of culture, humanity, and biology.
We're very interested in how people think about their bodies, how they're thinking about diseases, how they're thinking about threats, and what sorts of actions or responses come from those conceptions about diseases and threats.
The Ebola outbreak in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone is a medical emergency. But Langwick says there's more than one dimension to it.
When we focus only on the very important scientific questions and biological questions of the origins of this disease, its population dynamics, its spread, we may come up with a set of interventions that look very effective on paper in relation to containing the virus, but they're completely ineffective on the ground.
Past Ebola outbreaks in Africa were often over in a matter of weeks and occurred in small areas. Infected people were quickly isolated, and the outbreak ended when the dying stopped. But this outbreak crossed porous borders, has been going on for months, and the dying and new infections continue.
Part of what we're seeing is our intense interconnectedness in today's world. People travel, people need to travel to make their livelihoods, to get food, to see relatives, to care for each other, for their jobs and their profession. And I think we're seeing a very effective and devastating virus take advantage of the fact that we are a very interconnected world.
The Cornell professor says when people live in an area with poor health care, surrounded by death and the fear of death, it is an infuriating and terrifying situation. That's made worse, she says, when the areas are placed under quarantine, like the West Point area of Liberia's capital Monrovia, with little or no warning or education campaigns about Ebola.
The current violence in Monrovia really shows us that if we do not do that, what will then be required is force and violence in a situation where there's already so much loss, heartache, and death that adding to it is not what anyone is hoping will happen.
She says it's a question of how do we care for the people we love, especially in the face of danger. She describes it as the ethics of living, the ethics of caring. Even the way people mourn the death of their loved ones has changed in the affected countries. No longer, say health officials, can people touch dead bodies during funerals.
How can we actually make a meaningful grieving practice together? And parts of that grieving practice might have to be new. And traditions are very strong, and so they're not easy to break. But part of what can be a real drawback of highly focused public health interventions is they tell people what not to do, but they do not take the time to imagine with people what they can do.
Langwick says effective interventions are more easily accepted when they're based on consultations with a broad range of community members. She says working with traditional healers may help, as long as those healers are fully aware of the risks of Ebola. She says good healers are skillful in conceiving and promoting therapies that intervene in the dynamics of both the biological diseases and human relationships. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
This month, the World Health Organization declared the Ebola outbreak in West Africa a global public health emergency. Many international and national organizations are working to get supplies to medical teams in the field. The challenges facing the region and the international effort were topics of discussion earlier this month at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York. VOA's William Eagle reports.
Health officials say with Ebola's emergency designation, there will be a push to develop drugs to thwart the virus and to strengthen weakened national health care systems so they can identify, quarantine, and treat the infected. Needed urgently are medical technicians, nurses, doctors, epidemiologists, and trained health care workers. Some health care experts are concerned about the coordination of the response. Lori Garrett is a senior fellow for global health at the Council on Foreign Relations. She expresses concern about the funding needed to contain the virus. She says budget cuts may have diminished the capacity of the World Health Organization, one of the leading institutions involved in the emergency response.
Let's keep in mind, WHO has been running on a budget deficit. The World Health Assembly voted in their last session to cut the emergency epidemic response capacity of WHO. And if it weren't for this morning's announcement from the World Bank that it will put $200 million into the effort, we basically would have an effort on the ground in Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia, funded on fumes, volunteer donations, and, a few hundred people who are being unpaid to risk their lives in the middle of this outbreak.
Garrett says there should be a strategic plan that makes clear the chain of command in the relief effort. The plan would also take into consideration past failures in global health emergencies, including the swine flu in 2009. Though that virus developed in the U.S., Mexico was hit hard. Garrett says the country received little international support by being open about the problem.
Mexico followed all the rules of the game. They told the whole world, we have it. They were completely transparent and open. They tried to bring it under control. And the response of the international community was, whoa, shut the borders to Mexico. Don't let any Mexican planes land anywhere. Penalize Mexico for having this outbreak. That sent a message to the whole world. Wow, don't comply with regulations. Don't try and be a good global citizen in an outbreak, because the rest of the world is going to really not be kind to you for doing so.
A more appropriate solution, she says, would have been a strategy that includes coordinated government responses to such emergencies. Today, many states have ad hoc plans that often contradict each other. John Campbell is a Ralph Bunche Senior Fellow for Africa Policy Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's also a former U.S. ambassador to Nigeria. Campbell says countries could begin to devise protocols under the aegis of Africa's regional organizations, such as the African Union or ECOWAS, the Economic Community of West African States. Good governance also comes into play in managing the crisis. Campbell says one government that has responded well is Lagos State in Nigeria. When a man infected with Ebola arrived in the commercial capital, Lagos, officials began tracing everyone he'd come in contact with and quarantining him.
In Lagos, a highly effective governor has been succeeded by another highly effective governor. And something approaching a social contract in Lagos is now emerging. A social contract in which people pay taxes and hold their governments accountable for providing services.
But Campbell warns there's real potential in urban areas for the rapid spread of the virus. Slums are packed with people compared to rural areas where there's less density. Urban migrants may all speak dialects or languages from their region, which also makes education campaigns more difficult. Proposed solutions include involving in-information campaigns, influence makers, and religious leaders. Not all religious leaders or populations are amenable to Western health interventions. In northern Nigeria, polio vaccinators have been killed, and today the area is the site of fighting between the military and Boko Haram militants who reject Western education and medicine. As with others in West Africa, some northerners in Nigeria deny the existence of Ebola, or they say health workers are infecting them with the disease or with sterilizing medicines.
A huge unknown for us right now is how Boko Haram sees itself in the context of, you know, sort of global mobilized health campaigns, and whether if there were Ebola in northern Nigeria, Boko Haram would be as obstructive as many are now being on the ground in Sierra Leone and Liberia.
Both senior fellows of the Council on Foreign Relations says it's imperative for the international community to develop a comprehensive strategy for controlling emergency outbreaks like Ebola. Campbell says there are plenty of diseases in Africa that can turn into pandemics. And when Ebola burns itself out, he says, there's a good chance it will be replaced with something else. I'm William Eagle in Washington.
The South African Parliament has plunged into chaos yet again yesterday, forcing President Jacob Zuma to walk out in the middle of his address to the National Assembly. This was after the economic freedom fighters became unruly and violent during a question and answer session. As Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg, the ruling ANC is now calling for the strongest punitive sanctions to be placed on those involved.
Chaotic scenes erupted during a question and answer session with President Jacob Zuma concerning his private Nkandla home. Early this year, the public protector ordered Mr. Zuma to pay back to the state a portion of the $23 million used for security upgrades to the home. Mr. Zuma was in Parliament to explain his response to the public protector's report.
I have responded appropriately, and I am saying people who did the upgrades at Nkandla
Honourable members, please allow the president
always
to finish.
Determine who pays when to pay.
But the leader of the newly formed Economic Freedom Fighters, EFF, Julius Malema, who was expelled from the ruling ANC, partly for undermining Mr. Zuma's authority, demanded a precise response.
The question we're asking today, and we are not going to leave here before we get an answer, is when are you paying the money?
When President Zuma insisted that he had already answered the question, there was commotion as EFF members refused to take instructions from the Speaker of the House of Representatives.
Order. You're not paying.
We want Ntandamane. That's what we want.
It is at this point that Mr. Zuma decided to walk out. The Speaker then temporarily adjourned Parliament and called in riot police to eject EFF members, who violently refused and instead started chanting, "Pay back the money.
Pay back the money. Pay back the money. I think what we can.
When it was time for Parliament to resume, ANC members of Parliament charged towards the EFF members, leading to a scuffle as they pushed and shoved each other. This forced the Speaker to adjourn Parliament. While the EFF has received praises from those that are anti-ANC, political analyst Angelo Fick disagrees.
They have moral right, perhaps, on their side in the eyes of some of the observers, but they don't have the letter of the law on their side. The president and the African National Congress seem to be following the letter of the law, and they will follow the process through the ad hoc committee.
But constitutional expert Shadrack Guto blames President Zuma, saying the chaos was a result of his failure to respond to the public protector's report in a timely and precise manner.
They should have done it much more reasonably than they did. But the substance of it is that it is the presidency which is avoiding obeying the laws of the country.
In May, EFF members were ejected from Parliament when party leader Malema refused to withdraw a statement in which he accused the ANC of being responsible for killing 34 striking miners shot by police in Marikana. In the Gauteng legislature, EFF members were ordered to march out after coming into the house wearing red overalls and domestic workers' clothes. The ruling ANC is now calling on Parliament to slap the EFF members with the strongest sanction possible. In a strongly worded statement, the ANC warned the EFF not to provoke emotions, saying this could lead to political intolerance with dire consequences to the country's democracy. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
A Tunisian government crackdown on suspected radical Islamists that began last month has alarmed local and global rights groups. Since June, more than 150 civil associations have been suspended. About 20 mosques have been shut down, and television and radio stations and websites have been closed. Also, an estimated 1,000 people have been arrested. Observers say the actions were ordered by Prime Minister Meddai Djoma and representatives of the army, police, and the ministries of foreign affairs and religion. Djoma took office in January.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Outgoing UN Human Rights Commissioner Nabi Pillay scolds the UN Security Council for its lack of action on some of the world's most serious crises. The militant group Boko Haram seizes another town in northeastern Nigeria. And the total number of confirmed Ebola infections in Nigeria has risen to 14. Coming up, we have music from Ivory Coast. And in our feature segment, the West Africa Ebola turning out to be the worst outbreak of the disease ever. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehia Swuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. Happy Friday, Sunny.
Happy Friday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand tennis tops your sports report this evening.
Kim, my opening serve on the sunny side of sports is U.S. Open tennis. The year's final Grand Slam event begins Monday in New York. The top men's and women's seeds are Novak Djokovic of Serbia and Serena Williams of the USA. Djokovic, ranked number one in the world, has seven Grand Slam singles titles, including the 2011 U.S. Open trophy. His path to another trophy got easier earlier this week when defending men's champion Rafael Nadal of Spain withdrew with a wrist injury. Meanwhile, Serena Williams, also ranked number one in the world, is bidding for her third consecutive U.S. Open crown, an 18th Grand Slam singles title. If Serena wins the tournament again, she'll tie former stars Chris Evert and Martina Navratilova, who also won 18 Grand Slam singles titles.
It would be great, but I'm just really excited to be competing and to do the best that I can. At the end of the day, I always give my best, and that's all I can do, and that's all I can ask for. Obviously, I feel really good about my condition, but this is a fresh new week, and I want to feel good these next 2 weeks and not just the last few weeks.
Serena Williams will begin defense of her U.S. Open title against another American, 18-year-old Taylor Townsend, a former top-ranked junior player who reached the third round at the French Open this year. Townsend got into her first U.S. Open main draw with a wild card entry. Meanwhile, another American tennis player, Bethany Mattek-Sands, says Serena Williams hasn't won a Grand Slam title yet in 2014, and that will definitely motivate Serena in New York.
The thing that you got to talk about is the three slams this year. You know, she's been beat these three slams this year. So I think she's really hungry for this one. Not saying it's more important, but I think she's always expecting herself to win a slam, and she hasn't won one this year yet.
There's some big money at stake in the U.S. Open. A record total of more than $38 million U.S. dollars. The men's and women's singles champions in New York will each receive $3 million. Almighty Dollar, got money. I'm VOA's Sunny Young in Washington, and you're listening to the sunny side of sports on The Voice of America. An Egyptian weightlifter has won Africa's first gold medal at the Olympic Youth Games in Nanjing, China. Our Daybreak Africa sportsman Marco Uma has that story as well as other sports news.
Egypt's Ahmed Sara clinched Africa's first gold medal at the Games on Thursday. She triumphed in girls' 63-kilogram weightlifting contest. Cape Verde Islands thrashed Vanuatu 7-1 in boys' football. Ghana's Kwabena Philip and Nicolas Tete edged Peru's Luis Bramont Arias and Jimmy Herendia 2-1 in boys' beach volleyball. In handball, South Korea beat Angola 39-23 in the girls' contest, while Slovenia outclassed Tunisia 33-12 in the boys' event. In boys' table tennis, Egypt pipped Kazakhstan 2-1 before losing 3-0 to South Korea. In athletics news, Ethiopia's Mukhtar Edris triumphed in 5,000 meters in 12 minutes and 54.83 seconds, the world's fastest time for the event this year, at the IWF Diamond League in Stockholm, Sweden on Thursday. South African Godfrey Kotso-Mokwena won men's long jump. Ethiopian Hiwot Aeleo and Tunisia's Habiba Gribi secured a 1-2 African triumph in women's 3,000 meters steeple, which is, while Ethiopian Genzebe Dibaba and Djibouti's Ayanle Suleiman were second in women's 1500 meters and men's 800 meters, respectively. I'm Mark Oma in Johannesburg, South Africa, wishing you all a fabulous weekend.
Because this is Africa. This time for Africa.
I'm very excited.
Because this is Africa. Samina mina, waka waka, Samina mina, sakalewa. This time for Africa.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
And when you visit VOAnews.com, make sure you check out the Sunny Side of Sports blog, in which I write about a variety of sporty topics. Voice of America intern Daniel Brown is guest blogger for the latest Sunny Side of Sports blog post, titled Pitching Prodigy Monet Davis. The 13-year-old Davis, an African-American girl, is earning acclaim here in the USA for her pitching prowess and for showing what girls can do. She just recently became the youngest athlete ever to appear on the cover of Sports Illustrated magazine. Sports Illustrated put her on the cover after she became the first girl in history to get a win and pitch a shutout at the Little League Baseball World Series in the eastern U.S. city of Williamsport, Pennsylvania. Monet is known for her fastball, which she can throw 70 miles per hour. That's equivalent to a professional pitcher who can throw more than 90 miles per hour. And while she's doing some great things in baseball, Monet says her favorite sport is basketball, and she one day hopes to play professionally in the Women's National Basketball Association. On Thursday night at the Little League Baseball World Series, Monet's Philadelphia team was eliminated by Chicago's Jackie Robinson West, 6-5. Chicago will now play in the U.S. Championship game on Saturday against a Little League team from Las Vegas, Nevada. Jackie Robinson West is named after the late Hall of Fame player who broke Major League Baseball racial barriers in 1947. The Chicago team is made up of all black players, and it's making its first appearance in the Little League Baseball World Series in 31 years. Follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOASunny, and my Twitter handle is at @VOASunnySports. I received a Facebook message today, Friday, from Looper Adzagi, a loyal Voice of America listener in Abuja, Nigeria. Looper even gave me a weather report. He said there were rains in Abuja Thursday night and early Friday morning, and then the weather turn cloudy. Well, Looper, this is the sunny side of sports, so here's hoping the weather brightens in Nigeria's political capital. Looper says he wants to extend lovely and warm regards to the high-flying, unstoppable, and goal-reigning Falconets of Nigeria, who played Germany Sunday in the final of the FIFA Under-20 Women's World Cup football tournament in Montreal, Canada. Looper says when the Falconets bring the trophy back home to Nigeria, he'd be happy to let them keep it in his bedroom in Abuja.
Keep on the sunny side.
I'm Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to the sunny side of sports on the Voice of America.
Voice of America!
Veteran American goalkeeper Tim Howard says he's going to take a break from the U.S. men's national soccer team. Our VOA football fans will remember the 35-year-old Howard set a World Cup record for saves with 16 in the USA's 2-1 loss to Belgium in extra time in the round of 16 in Brazil. In a statement distributed by the U.S. Soccer Federation, Howard said, and I quote, "Having played overseas for the last 12 years and missing out on spending time with my family, making this commitment to my family is very important at this time. I'm grateful for the willingness of both U.S. coach Jurgen Klinsmann and Everton manager Roberto Martinez to afford me the opportunity to spend time with my two children." Tim Howard has been the first choice U.S. goalkeeper for 7 years, and he started in 2 World Cups. Last weekend, Tim Howard began his 9th season as Everton's first choice goalkeeper in the English Premier League. Howard says he's looking forward to resuming his international career in September 2015, although U.S. coach Klinsmann says he'll need to prove that he deserves to be back on the team. Tim Howard also recently signed a multi-year agreement with NBC Sports Television to be an analyst for the network's English Premier League coverage. Howard's television assignments will be scheduled around Everton's matches. Everton drew 2-2 with Leicester in its English Premier League opener last weekend. Tim Howard and Everton will be back on the pitch Saturday when Everton hosts Arsenal at Goodison Park in its next match. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Have a good weekend, everyone. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And today, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 hours UTC right here on The Voice of America.
Coming up, the West Africa Ebola turning out to be the worst outbreak ever. And next, making art from animal bones. But first, some music. Here is Ivory Coast, Tiken Jaffa Kole with African Revolution.
Education.
understand what they are doing. It will open your eyes to the people's situation. Go to school, my brother. I said, go to school. You will understand very soon all the problems of your nation. We want a revolution. Young people revolution. Intelligent revolution. Must be African education. In your mind, brother, there is the power to change the world. This understanding will help to make a better place. In your hands, brother, there is the key.
Ivory Coast, Diken Jafakole with African Revolution.
Well, the Ebola outbreak has killed more than 1,300 people in Guinea, Sierra Leone, Liberia, and now Nigeria. This is the first time West Africa has seen Ebola, and it is turning out to be the worst outbreak of the disease ever, in part because people either don't know what to do or are refusing to comply with public health recommendations. Health experts say education may be more effective than enforcement. And look, reports from West Africa with reporting by Adam Bales in Freetown and Prince Collins in Monrovia.
Good afternoon, my people. We have come in your community this afternoon to tell you about the danger of Ebola.
More of this is what public health experts say may turn the tide against Ebola. Health worker Bunch Wia met with a community in Margibi County, Liberia.
Ebola has no cure. Ebola has no cure. But what you can do is to prevent yourself. What you can do is to prevent yourself from the deadly disease. Please stop eating bush meat. Please start touching your friend. Please start shaking hands. These are ways people can catch the Ebola disease.
People have plenty of questions.
So can I ask you? Yes, I want to know, they say Ebola don't have cure, but what happened when they take
this man says if there's no cure, then what can doctors do for people at the hospital? What's the point of going there? It's a common area of confusion. Health workers continue to remind people that some patients are fighting off the disease with medical care. They emphasize that for containment to work, sick people must be isolated so they don't infect others, and that every person who had contact with an Ebola patient's bodily fluids must be monitored in case any of those people get sick. That's how you stop the chain of infection. But that isn't happening everywhere in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone, the countries hit hardest by the Ebola outbreak. The virus spread quickly across those countries' borders starting earlier this year. People did not know what the disease was. Some infected people hid from authorities or ran away. Families continued to handle and bury the bodies of Ebola victims. And so the disease continued to spread. Stephane Doyen, the West Africa chief for Doctors Without Borders, says that communities continue to resist medical assistance and more education is needed. Doyen says in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and certain parts of Guinea, where we have trouble accessing certain villages, we know there are probably cases there, that people are dying and that the disease is spreading, but we can do nothing. He says we either don't know about the cases or the population won't let us in because they don't understand we are there to help. Liberia and Sierra Leone have deployed security forces to enforce containment measures and protect health workers amid growing hostility. It's illegal to knowingly harbor someone who has Ebola. Liberia is considering quarantining affected zones. Sierra Leone already has. But can the outbreak be stopped through such dramatic measures? Dr. Uni Krishnan, the head of Disaster Response and Prevention for Plan International.
These measures will have limitations. So this is where informing people, educating people, and encouraging them to come forward when they see symptoms is key. That's what will be finally be yielding results.
He says more international funds are needed for nearly every aspect of this response effort, especially education. Meanwhile, health workers continue going door to door. They're handing out leaflets and tying up signs with hand-drawn pictures of the various symptoms. and putting catchy songs on the radio, scrambling to get to people before Ebola does. Look at Guinea, look at Sevelin, from the Boloy and Sakala. Y'all won't tell me you can't believe. And look, the Iranians, Dakar.
A group of enterprising young people in Kibera, Nairobi's largest slum, have turned to making art from animal bones. The jewelry items range in price from $3 to $5 and are a big hit with locals and tourists alike. Lenny Ruvaga has the story from Kibera, Kenya.
This is the Soweto restaurant, located in the sprawling Kibera slum. The restaurant serves around 500 people a day and at any given time is filled with customers. Today is no exception. Restaurant owner Mutua Mutiso says his customers like meat.
Our food is very delicious. We normally serve head meat and legs and bananas. That is why my customer like the food.
But some of his customers, like George Otieno, prefer the bones. Otieno is the 25-year-old co-founder of Victorious Bones, a youth group that began 8 years ago with the purpose of turning bones into art. Otieno buys discarded bones for his workshop once a month from Soweto Restaurant.
The bones we are buying are the camel bones or cow bone, goat bone and sheep bone. So the camel bone we buy at $3, cow bone at $2, and the rest at $1. The bones we are buying because they are our raw material.
Back at the workshop, not far from the Soweto restaurant, he cuts and sharpens the bones using a circular blade and then smooths them down with sandpaper. The next step is boiling the bones with hydrogen peroxide to remove oil on the surface and to make it easier to apply color. Otieno explains.
After boiling, we split them. After splitting them, we grind them to make the shapes. Then we drill them. After drilling them, we then dye them. And then we polish them to make the final product.
The bones then become earrings, necklaces, bracelets, and rings. Depending on the complexity of design, a piece of jewelry can take 6 to 20 hours to complete. Otieno says his Victorious Bones group can make 500 earrings and 150 to 200 necklaces a day, depending on the order.
There's a lot of competition. Currently, we depend mostly on tourists who come to visit the slums. We also sell abroad. We have our two customers in Finland and Canada. Yeah. So, for example, we have bought Lopena, which goes to $6. We have the necklace, same to $6, and the salad spoon, which goes to $8.
Victorious Bones partnered with an organization called SEED, which stands for Students Empowerment Through Education and Development, which brings in tourists to buy the jewelry and find new markets for the art. Patrick Aoki is the director at SEED.
SEED Foundation actually partners with Victorious Youth Group to buy their finished products and looks for market to be able to provide an opportunity for employment for them, because getting jobs is a big challenge to the youths in the slums, and we have to empower them by marketing the finished products for them to be able to make some money.
With no capital to buy equipment and rent a workshop, Otieno and his four friends began by pooling their meager savings. They each contributed $1 per week, and within a year, they were able to buy their first machine and get a space for their workshop. Profits, says Otieno, were put back into the workshop to expand.
Oh, we have the grinder machine and the drill. The grinder machine has a capacity of 500 per day, which we can produce. Oh, currently, we employ 11 people who are working, and this is the source of livelihood, which can help them to with their families.
Victorious Bones has also trained more than 40 young people from the slums, giving them a marketable skill and a more viable future. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Nairobi, Kenya.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Peter Hundley, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Simply put, without the ocean, there is no life on Earth. At the most basic level, the ocean produces 50 to 70% of our oxygen. It regulates our climate, absorbs carbon dioxide, and supports the greatest abundance of life on our planet. Today, some 12% of the global population makes its livelihood from the sea. And therein lies the problem. We humans are killing the ocean. As fishermen endeavor to supply the demand for seafood, they take too many fish, particularly the more popular species. Today, an estimated 29% of the world's fish stocks are overexploited, while another 61% cannot support expanded harvest and require effective management to avoid decline. Some stocks of tuna, swordfish, halibut, cod and flounder populations have been devastated by overfishing. The ocean is threatened today as never before, said Secretary of State John Kerry. It is threatened by overpollution. It is threatened by climate change, which is having a profound impact on acidity of the ocean, which has an impact on all of the ecosystem, and it is profoundly affected by overfishing. There is too much money chasing too few fish, and most of the major fisheries of the world are either in extremis or near extremis. The Obama administration is particularly committed to improving the health of our ocean and is considering ways to expand protections for vast expanses of the Pacific Ocean, where the United States has jurisdiction. At Secretary Kerry's Our Ocean Conference in Washington this past June, participants from around the globe announced new commitments on the protection of more than 3 million square kilometers of the ocean, and dedicated more than $800 million to conserve the ocean and its resources. We are committed to addressing the threats to the health of the oceans posed by climate change, as we have reduced our greenhouse gas emissions through strong action in the U.S., putting us on the path to meeting the U.S. goal of reducing emissions in range of 17% below 2005 levels by 2020, said Secretary Kerry. Our hope is that in the next few years, there will be a new consciousness created about the responsibility to the ocean and the extraordinary connection of the ocean to everything we do and need to do on Earth itself.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOANews.com.